So Alice is tracking. She's speaking once a month at the moment, and she's developing a theme, a series on how Jesus on Jesus is King over time. As always, the talks are always a podcast on our website and on Spotify and that sort of thing. And yeah, this one's going to be quite. I heard this last night, and Alice and I went through it, and I think it's great. So want to pray for us now as we look at the Word together, and as Alice teaches us, and as we said in the first half, Lord, we say again, we want to follow you with all of our heart. We want to see your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. We want to be people like those people in the All Through History song who pursued the bigger vision, the better story that Jesus came to show us and introduce us to. And what Alice is bringing today is part of that, part of us inhabiting that better life that you have for us. So pray that you feed us through what she says, you teach us, you equip us, that we can be salt and light to the world, bringing the goodness of Jesus. Amen.
Thank you. Can we have the first slide up, please? So just if the parents, if your young people are in this room, are you giving parental permission? Great. So some of you might have come across the movie Barbie, which apparently, along with Oppenheimer, boosted the American economy in 2023. There you go. There is a book called Lessons in Chemistry, which has made a series, and a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, and a book. So I try and always, not always, but as much as possible, quote things I've read or watched. And then I just saw that, Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism. So I just thought, I'll just put that up there too. Didn't have enough time to read that. When in 2022, post hashtag Me Too 2019, someone has to write a book like this and there's a publisher willing to market it, you know something's gone terribly wrong in the relationship between men and women. I actually, just as a heads up for those in the know, Louise Perry writes this book. I resisted it for about a year or two to read because she writes for the Mail Online, which I personally struggle with. I think it's a divisive paper, but I also have a conviction that when we stay in our lane and we have something worth saying, which I think she does on this issue, it's worth paying attention, listening. So I did finally read it, and actually it's really interesting on this issue. The foreword is by someone called Kathleen Stock, who was actually, I think she lost her job. Not going to go into that, but the fact she wrote a foreword on this is very interesting. So that's just a little aside for those who might have a question mark over this author. The point I'm making, bigger picture, is if someone has to write a book called that, as I said before, you know something's gone terribly wrong culturally. And Lessons in Chemistry and Barbie similarly came out really, really recently. And they're all kind of saying a similar thing, despite, you know, hashtag Me Too, despite third, fourth wave feminism, something's not working. So what I'm not going to do, I'm not going to address Islam. It's not my story to address. I'm not going to address LGBTQ. We do that elsewhere. I'm always happy to have a conversation about anything. We've done it online. You can find that content. I'm also not going to address things that are happening in the American Evangelical Church. Again, it's not my story to tell. I'm trying to address what I think the one thing Jesus is addressing in the text we've come to on the Sermon on the Mount, which is the power dynamics between male and female. I think that's what he's doing in first century Judaism, and we can look at what he's trying to do and look at how we can apply it now. So I'm going to try my hardest to stay in my lane. I have lots of thoughts about lots of things. So if you hear me going on a tangent, rein me back in to that one concept we're looking at, which is the power dynamic between male and female. So these are all sensing there's some sort of problem, but as we will find out, none of them resolve it. And I also just want to call out right now, the reason Barbie works and the reason lessons in chemistry work is because the primary female character is desirable in the eyes of the male gaze, which I'm going to come to. It's a Genesis 3 lens through which we see the world. So the irony even of feminist literature now and feminist media is it's still colluding with the lie of Genesis 3. We have really good news because we've been given everything we need to recover the vision and the mutuality of Genesis 1. I'm going to come to that later. Let's look at the teachings of Jesus, because what I'm going to contend for and what many other Christians throughout history have contended for is there was one successful sexual revolution where everyone was truly liberated, and it was through the teachings of Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. So if we could go to the next slide. This is exactly where we've come through in the text. If you want to know the context, just listen once a month. I'm doing a teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, and this is where we've got to. It's like Jesus's manifesto for how we can be salt and light, a countercultural prophetic community in the world, anticipating new creation to come. You have heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. The task before me is to convert everyone here to the idea that it is better for you to lose one part of your body. If your right eye causes you to stumble, to gouge it out, and to chop off your hand. Paul, as well, we're talking at the teachings of Jesus in his Greco-Roman context, also says similar things. There must not even be a hint of sexual morality. The Greek word for that is porneia, from which we get the word pornography. In Ephesians, flee from sexual immorality, 1 Corinthians. And Galatians 5, the acts of the flesh, the sarx, the old nature, are obvious. And the first on the list, sexual immorality. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. So Christians have been accused over the years, oh my God, you're so repressed, puritanical, what the heck is wrong with you? Why can't you just relax and enjoy sex and your sexuality? But what I find slightly ironic about Freud, where we get the word repression from, is in every other area of life, we call it restraint. If a car is carving me up, and I have road rage, but I don't retaliate, it's called restraint. If I want to say a whole load of stuff to someone in anger, and I don't, it's restraint. If I want to blow my bill, my budget for the month, on something that I know is not going to be helpful financially, I call it restraint. And if I want to eat that whole chocolate cake, but I choose not to, it's called restraint. But for some reason, when it comes to sexual desire, it's called repression. He uses the word hell. I'm going to explain. Can we go to the next slide? This is me overlooking Jerusalem. There is a valley outside Jerusalem called Ben Hinnom. It's really unhelpful when we just hear the word hell because we've got a lot of baggage over it. Don't forget the context of this teaching is how to thrive in this age. It's how to build your house on the rock rather than the sand and withstand the intense stresses and strains of what it is to be human in this age. So there are issues about the afterlife and new creation and so-called and the resurrection of the body, which I think Bill and I would like to address at some point next year, but that is not the context of this teaching. This teaching is referring to a Hebrew Bible context, which Jesus would have been familiar with, of a valley outside Jerusalem called Ben Hinnom, translated into Greek Gehenna and translated into English hell, where the worst and most evil kings of Judah would practice idolatry, including at their worst under Manasseh, sacrificing their children in the fire to the god Molech. Jeremiah, a prophet in the Old Testament, calls them to account and he says, the fire you're kindling, you're burning your children in, will be the fire that burns you up. And sure enough, in the Babylonian exile, the Babylonians come, they conquer Jerusalem, they set fire to the whole thing, and the elite, including those apostate kings, are sent into exile, killed or enslaved. That is the historical context for those first century listeners to Jesus. The fire you kindle through self-gratification will be the fire that burns you up. That's what he's talking about. Forget the afterlife. We're talking about the consequences in this age for actions that our bodies simply can't sustain. If we go to the next one. We went, and the one after this, one afterwards. So we went to the Clifton Suspension Bridge Museum, and it's brilliant. They did this competition, which you probably all know, of like, how can we get a bridge across the gorge? And people just put in these ideas of pretty bridges. And there's a 16-year-old, actually, if you go, and it's just a lovely little bridge. And they're like, rejected, 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 because none of them have the physics to actually hold up a horse and carriage, let alone what Isambard Kingdom Brunel couldn't see, what we can see now, lorries going across that bridge. But the engineer, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, did submit what became known as Clifton Suspension Bridge. It was accepted, although there was some hesitancy and he didn't even see it in his lifetime. But his physics was able to sustain 21st century traffic. This is exactly the image that Jesus is talking about. When you build your house on the rock, you build your life, your family, your community, your society, your culture on a rock, or you build it on the sand. It's called credit card living, building on the sand. Pleasure now and pay with interest, a lot of interest later. Or you pay now in agape, self-sacrificial, daily sacrificial, put the flesh to death, love, and you build a house that can sustain the stresses and strains and immense pressure of what it is to be human. So when Jesus is saying what sounds incredibly intense language, it's because he knows what it requires to build a bridge that will cross the gorge in terms of how we handle our sexuality. He knows everything we need to live in order for us to be successful and flourishing. Don't forget, this is actually about the key to the good life. The entire Sermon on the Mount is, this is the way to the good life. You think it's some other way, but this is what it consists of. Now, I was talking to a friend here earlier, and I wanted an idea for how we are continually contextualizing words all the time. We're always interpreting with our brain everything in order to understand the world. And we do that with words all the time, and we do it with words in the Bible all the time. So we hear the word marriage, and we hear the word divorce, and immediately, rightly so, in order to navigate through the world, we're thinking 21st century Western no-fault divorce. That's what we're thinking of immediately. We're also thinking men and women sue for divorce. We're also thinking men and women chose to be married in the first place. We're also thinking monogamy. We're thinking a whole load of stuff associated with the words marriage and divorce that probably weren't in the mindset of those first century hearers of Jesus' teaching. So this brilliant example was someone who was saying their mum was coming into the kind of Christian community and had never been to a bring and share lunch before. It was in New Zealand. And they said, you know, church lunch, bring a plate. So she turns up with a plate. That's contextual understanding. Anyone in the context knows you bring a plate of food. You don't just bring a plate. But she didn't have that filter. She just read, bring a plate. So she brought a plate. When you read the word divorce, I know it's annoying. We're like, why can't we just read these words and understand them? Why do people have to put them in their context? It is what it is. God embodied himself in a first century Jewish rabbi under Greco-Roman rule. That he contextualized himself, and we need to understand his context in order to understand ours. So divorce in the ancient world is very different to our context. In Judaism, the bride and groom were the last people to have a say in their wedding day. It was not based on the 21st century concepts of chemistry and compatibility between the bride and groom. It was based on an idea of compatibility maybe between two families, but it would have been based on other factors like financial security, a form of pension, and so on. Women could rarely initiate divorce at all, both in Roman and Jewish contexts, apart from wealthy women. Wealthy women have always been able to do what they like. Just a little heads up, because money really is important to us humans and tends to enable people to violate even these male-female dynamics. We'll come across money further down the line in the teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. But most women, certainly the women listening to Jesus' teaching, could not initiate divorce. Divorce was given 1,000 years ago in the Mosaic law to Jewish people, so it would have been seen as an ancient text to them. It was 1,000 years earlier, codified probably during the exile, about 500 years before. And there was this big rabbinic discussion going on that we are wading into, like bringing our plate, and we have no idea what the conversation was. And the conversation was basically this interpretation of a very niche verse in Deuteronomy, which says a man can initiate divorce if he finds something indecent, is an English translation, about his wife. And there were two rabbinic approaches. One was the more maybe strict, you might say, high bar, which is that means she's committed adultery. That's the issue, and that's the only legitimate grounds for suing for divorce. The other, you might say more liberal or more relaxed approach, was no, she has done anything to annoy you, and they even use the example of burnt toast, which I find weird because the toasters didn't exist then. So maybe they meant like bread on a fire that was overfired. The point is, they're trying to trick Jesus in Matthew 19, if you look at that later, and this is part of that conversation, Matthew 5 and Matthew 19. They're trying to trick Jesus because the Pharisees are on the stricter side, they're concerned Jesus is a bit liberal, and they're trying to catch him out. So not only is it a different context to our understanding of divorce and marriage, but it's also a trick question. Which side are you on? Because we want to call you out. And his answer is aligned with the stricter interpretation of the Torah, which would please the Pharisees. But he kind of goes a step further and calls out their hypocrisy and disingenuous religious judgmentalism. So if you can imagine in a society, a Jewish society, where a man can issue a certificate of divorce, divorce equals remarriage. That's something we also don't understand. It was a legitimate way to marry again. In our culture, in the West, 50% of people, this is unprecedented, of traditionally marriageable age, say 18 to 40 something, are single. This is unheard of in history. This has never, ever been the case. In the ancient world and in first century Judaism, you pretty much needed to be married, especially as a woman, because it was your financial security, it was your family line and your inheritance, and so on. So you couldn't just get divorced and then live a single life like many people do today. So what you're doing, if you're a man and you're issuing a certificate of divorce to a woman, you're essentially forcing her to remarry, to have sex with someone else. In other words, forcing her to commit adultery. That's the point Jesus is making. So you can only have legitimate permission to do that if she's already done that. So it's actually about adultery. And that is, on after incest, the two by miles largest prohibitions, hundreds of prohibitions over adultery and incest in the Mosaic law, way above any other prohibition on sexual behavior, is a massive theme at the heart of God, because adultery is tantamount in the Hebrew Bible to spiritual idolatry. It's, if the imagery is Yahweh is married to his people through the Sinaitic covenant, then adultery looked like the people of Israel and Judah worshipping other gods. So it was so close to his heart, adultery, the prohibition of adultery, because it was breaking covenant faithfulness, which represents the breaking of covenant faithfulnesses between God and humanity, or Christ and the church, as it came to be in the New Testament. And at the same time, he's also calling out a power abuse dynamic within the male-female relationship in first century Judaism. He's saying it is unacceptable, just because you think you can issue a certificate of divorce, to do that on the grounds of she irritates you, so she then has to get married and have sex with someone else. You're causing her to be a victim of adultery. And I heard, I used the NIV version, and I heard one of the women on the translation committees, how they processed using that term because of that reason. And he's saying, no, that is not appropriate. That marriage, and we get to it more with Paul, is an act of self-sacrificial agape love from your thought life onwards. So no, you can't just issue a certificate of divorce and force a woman to do things that she doesn't want to do against her will. So I think two things are going on there. He's absolutely affirming the union between a man and woman for life, that the act of adultery breaks. He is affirming that. But he is also affirming a Genesis 1 dynamic of mutuality and partnership within that marriage union. And we see that Paul affirms that in his teaching in Ephesians 5. He calls the man to lay down his life for his wife with the same level of agape love as Christ has for the church, restoring the mutuality of Genesis 1 in the light of Genesis 3. Our approach to divorce here, as a result, is case by case, because that's what we see Jesus role modeling. Paul had another case study. It was desertion. People would leave their spouses when they came to faith. Say a Jewish person came to faith in Jesus, or a Gentile, and their spouse didn't want to live with them. He says, that's okay, you can let them go. That is legitimate grounds for divorce, because it legally protects you and it honors them and releases both of you. So there are legitimate cases for divorce that feel more like case studies. So we have an incredibly high bar on marriage here. It's one man, one woman for life. And at the same time, we understand concession. Concession came in. There's a few divorce laws, and there's even a concession over polygamy in the Mosaic law, which Jesus ends in his teaching in Matthew 19. Because we live in an age where we have to live with our sin nature. God embodies this contradiction and paradox. He says he hates divorce in Malachi. He also issues a certificate of divorce in Hosea. So he understands what it's like to embody both. Can we go to the next one? Keep going. Okay, this is the harder bit, I think, because although that's very painful, that is still about our outward public behavior in the world, our legal, social, and religious status. Are we single? Are we married? Are we divorced? Which is an issue, and it is important we just simply agape love each other. Wherever we're at, we just love each other into the fullness of who we can be. We contend for the best for each other. But the reason I did that first is I actually think Jesus goes to the heart of the issue as well. And he basically says there are only two ways to do sexuality on earth. We might see a Clifton suspension bridge that looks shiny and think we've got another way, but it doesn't sustain what it is to be human sufficiently for it to work. There are two ways we do it. We do it through the Genesis 3 lens. So in Genesis 1, male and female were created to rule over creation and mutuality, representing God's image. But what happened in Genesis 3 when we chose to rule in our own wisdom is, as Lucy Peppiot, who's the prince of the college I'm doing theology with, said, the saddest verse in the Bible is that it said the male will rule over the female and her desire will be for him. So what began a mutuality vision in Genesis 1 becomes a dominance desire dynamic. And as soon as you see it everywhere. It's just everywhere. It's even in feminism. There's a dominance desire dynamic in how people read the Bible. There's a dominance desire dynamic in how people relate to each other, how men relate to men, women relate to women, men and women relate. Essentially what happens is we regress to what I call the harem. This is a kind of image I'm sort of thinking up. So if you think of the mountain is like where heaven and earth are one, the union between Christ and the church, the male and female ruling in mutuality, speaking to Revelation 22, the new creation. That's the design. And I would say it's not just designed for marriages, it's designed for mutual partnership between brothers and sisters in Christ. In fact, probably more that. There's a mutuality, there's a sibling partnership, there's a vision of a beautiful way of life at the top of the mountain. And then what we do always, if we don't live into that, is we regress to the harem. In the ancient world, you literally had a king who took all the women. In our imaginative world, I'm going to come to that in a minute, we do that, and increasingly now in the digital world and the AI world and even robotics, we can actually live out that fantasy. When I say we, what I'm trying to do is be neutral and honour what I think Jesus is saying is the dynamic between male and female. In the case against the sexual revolution, Louise Perry makes the point that basically what happened in the liberation was that instead of, for social stigma reasons and fear of getting pregnancy, a woman could say no to having sex. Now, those reasons have gone, because Plan A contraception, Plan B abortion, 1 in 4 babies in America are aborted. That's gone. Now, the trajectory for young women, teenagers and 20s, legally and culturally affirmed, I'm not talking about within Christian circles, I'm talking about within secular culture, is she has to have sex on the first or second date, and she also has to experience some kind of violence and find it pleasurable. She has been completely disempowered through this sexual revolution, which is actually a regression to the harem rather than an elevation to the heaven on earth that Jesus has designed us to live in. So a combination of the Sunday Times in 2022 and her book, you can imagine I don't Google and research porn on my phone because I don't want anything to do with that algorithm. So any research on porn is because I find it in articles or books. So sorry, this is 2022 and 2023, not 2024, but it's the closest I could get. So the top three porn sites receive 5.81 billion visits a month. Porn sites get more traffic, website traffic, than Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Netflix, Pinterest, and Zoom combined. And also in Louise Perry's book talks about, includes Facebook in that. 77% of Pornhub's UK traffic was via smartphone in 2020. 1 in 8 porn titles shown to first-time visitors describe acts of sexual violence. 1.5 million people in Britain use their work devices to watch porn. 50% of children aged 11 to 13 have been exposed. 66% of 14 to 15-year-olds. And 63% of 16 to 17-year-olds have been viewed porn via social media platforms, not porn sites. 55% of men told a BBC report in 2019 that porn was their main source of sexual education. And in that same survey, men aged between 18 to 39 say 35% of them choked their partner during consensual sex. There's a brilliant phrase that someone said the other day about something else. This is not our fault. It is not our fault. None of us thought, oh, I'd like to really be born into a pornified culture. That would be great if my smartphone could just access these images. But it is our responsibility. It's not our fault, especially if anyone here is under the age of 18. I actually think it's a form of child abuse, and I'm going to come to that in a minute, against teenage boys particularly. But it is our responsibility, because there are three giants who are not taking responsibility. The smartphone industry does not have age restriction. Anyone can have a smartphone. Social media sites have an age restriction, but they don't have, there's a law, the ones in America, the Silicon Valley ones, there is a law that says they don't take responsibility for anything on their sites. That one law makes it the Wild West out there. One law. Because it's in government interest to maximize profit, and it's also a political approach of anti-interference, which I understand in certain industries. Pretty grateful they interfered on the Industrial Revolution, putting children into factories. I think we're very disingenuous when we care or don't care about government interference. And then the third is legal porn, because it's supposedly over the age of consent, both the people in it, the women in it, and the majority men watching it. There's this perfect storm of three giants not taking personal responsibility. What I love about Jesus as an embodied male is he's like, we step up, we take responsibility for our thought life. None of those things have power if we don't consume them. We can totally resist it by becoming completely objectification, self-gratification, and porn-free as a community. But not just that, because she says, ditch porn, there's no good in it. We replace it, don't forget, with self-sacrificial agape love for one another, whether we're married or single. She can only do what religions can do, which is try and cut things off. But what we can do is receive a new nature from Jesus Christ himself, who was mutilated in his body to death for our sake, in order that our bodies may be able to reflect his way of life. There's a stunning moment in John 8 where there is a woman who is caught in the act of adultery. Probably means she was naked or scantily clad. There was certainly no respect for her modesty. But Jesus didn't once objectify her. He was able to see her as a man. He was able to look at her, have clarity on what the Father wanted to say to her. Say, draw a line in the sand. I don't condemn you. Go up, live your original design. Don't sin anymore. Don't fall short anymore. Absolutely incredible righteousness that he's given us. Because what he's doing in the Sermon on the Mount is he's handing us all over to disobedience. We all fall short in that dominance-desire dynamic. We're all marred by Genesis 3. And if anyone thinks we're above that, we're completely deluded. But what he does is he embodies, in this world, a male body, walks straight through it, out the other side, total Genesis 1, mutuality. He's not impressed by women, he's not seduced by them, he's not fearful of them. He totally walks in mutuality with them as his sisters in the faith, and he enables all of us to do the same. That's the righteousness that surpasses the religious elite. That's the righteousness that surpasses having to cut parts of your body off. It's a righteousness that comes from within that he gives us by the baptism of the Holy Spirit, where we can literally love our neighbor with agape love as ourselves. The tragic outcome of our pornified culture is three things. Firstly, neural pathways are formed in young people such that they cannot be physically aroused by real people. Secondly, it then begins to affect fertility. And thirdly, the irony of all is it gives us what we're receiving, the biggest pandemic of all, absolutely excruciating crisis-level loneliness. So the very thing designed to be something that brings people together by forming resilient marriages and resilient families, resilient communities, is the very thing the enemy is using to destroy people's personal lives, family lives, social lives. Apparently people, young people, are now having less sex than their parents and grandparents. The thing that God said was tov, beautiful or good, male tov, exceedingly beautiful or good, in Genesis 1, is the very thing that people are not even able to experience anymore. But the good news is, Jesus brought in a sexual revolution that actually worked, because he changed our nature and our capacity and restored us to love our neighbour as ourselves, whether that's our spouse, whether that's someone in our lives, or whether that's a family member. Because the pornified culture is a bit like the smoking culture. Passive users can get cancer too. This is in our culture and it affects all of us. We're all in this together. And we're all going to get out of it together as a community. And we're going to get out of it together by living how we do here. We call each other up to better, to our original design. We call each other to deal with our stuff through confession of sin appropriately. If this is an area that we struggle with, we have Celebrate Recovery. We have friends you can confess your sin to. If you want to, and it's appropriate, and you can within your marriage. That's how Chris and I deal with this stuff. We bring everything in the light in our marriage. If you feel so different and there's so much difficulty in you bringing things into the light, pay a therapist and tell them. Like, just get it out there. The enemy loves secrecy. As soon as it's in the light, you're free. But that's what we do here. And then we walk in the opposite spirit. What does agape, self-sacrificial love, look like for me in my marriage or in my single status? Whether I have children or not, what does agape love look like? We don't stop at resisting self-gratification, we move into self-sacrificial agape love in our thought and our word and our deed. This is a brilliant book about how we're all Christianized in the West. It's the air we breathe, how we all came to believe in freedom, kindness, progress, equality, but we just don't realize it because it's the air we breathe. And he talks about monogamous marriage. Her last chapter, she's a secular feminist, has no religious affiliation. Her last chapter against, and her arguments for treating women differently to men are through science, that female physiology is different to male physiology. But ironically, right at the end, she says a very non-scientific thing, because no mammals have monogamous relationships. She's like, basically, marriage is good. It's the only solution we have. Everyone should just get married. But he knows why. He knows why. She's like someone in the dark who's like, I think there's something about this thing that works. But he knows why, because he's a Christian. And he says, marriage the way we do it is not natural. It's weird. By which he's understanding the Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic nations, what's different about them. And when human societies, within human societies, monogamy is almost as rare. But if marriage proves too much of a commitment, Jesus offers an alternative in Matthew 19, but only one. Live like a eunuch. As Karl Harper puts it, the original sexual revolution, all the world's diffuse erotic energy was cramped into one frail sacred union. Joseph Henrich calls this teaching the marriage and family program. Henrich identifies it as the single contributor, listen to this, the single contributor to the West's weird psychology and remarkable prosperity. In cultures where high-status men, remember the harem, call the shots, they take all the women. This is terrible for the women and for the other men. The marriage and family program, Jesus's way, redistributes sex and marriage across the sexes and the classes. In theory, anyone can find a mate. And this suppresses male-male reproductive competition, drains the pool of unmarried men, a dangerous pool full of self-styled, involuntary celibates, high on testosterone and low on responsibility. The marriage and family program, Jesus's way, drastically reduces that pool and instead ties men to their women and their children. Their sexual choices and the consequences of those choices. As men are bound to family life, this acts naturally as a testosterone suppression system, lowering the aggression of the male population. And this is my favorite little quote. The church, through the institution of monogamous marriage, reached down and grabbed men by the testicles. He's saying, in the dominance-desire dynamic, the way to restore mutuality, because women have borne the disproportionate burden of that dynamic, men need to bear disproportionately the responsibility to self-sacrificial agape love in the expression of their sexuality. It's exactly what Paul says too. There are lots of examples in the New Testament where the words, you could might understand it if I use the word mankind, where we know it's talking to men and women, and now we might say human or humanity. But this text is as a man, Jesus, he's talking to men, embodied men, about how they look at women. And saying, if you look, you're breaking covenant. No one says that anywhere else. Everyone says, cover her up or restrain yourself. Restrict, cut off. But no one says, I can do something in your thought life that enables you to look at her with agape, self-sacrificial love. I actually think, for any young person, anyone who has an addiction, porn addiction, and it invariably started in teenage years because there's this somehow legitimated targeting of 12 to 17-year-old boys. Remember those three giants that don't take responsibility in the middle. When men are forming, the adolescent bodies are forming, they are targeted with the most graphic images instantly. There's no build-up. It's straight to the incredible high you can get immediately on that first image. It's designed for immediate addiction and compulsion, and then it needs more and more to feed that addiction, like any addiction. I call that child abuse, because those people watching that are under the age, a lot of them are under the age of consent, and even if they're between 17 and 18-year-old, they're not adults. So we're all in this together. We're going to carry each other's burdens, and we're going to get out of this together by listening to the teachings of Jesus, who hands us all over to disobedience. He says we all need help. We all need restoration. And then he gives us a new nature. He gives us the good news of a new thought life, a new imagination, a newer heart, where we can walk in the opposite spirit. I thought it's unbelievable that in the 1950s, C.S. Lewis says this. For me, the real evil of masturbation would be that it takes an appetite which in lawful use leads the individual out of himself. Remember what I'm saying about agape love, self-sacrificial love, to complete and correct his own personality in that of another, and finally his children and grandchildren. And he turns it back, sends the man back into the prison of himself, there to keep a harem of imaginary brides. And this harem, once admitted, and think of this in the area of AI and robotics that's coming in, remember my image of the imaginative and the digital harem, and this harem, once admitted, works against his ever getting out and really uniting with a real woman. For the harem is always accessible, always subservient, calls for no sacrifices or adjustments, and can be endowed with erotic and psychological attractions which no woman can rival. Among those shadowy brides, he is always adored, always the perfect lover. No demand is made on his unselfishness, no mortification ever imposed on his vanity. And then, conversely, in another work called The Weight of Glory, he writes the opposite. Because don't forget, we're not just about not doing that thing. We're about walking in the opposite spirit and doing the kingdom thing. If we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that the Lord finds our desires not too strong. We think they're so strong, don't we? But too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. And then he talks about a moment for him of sexual temptation. Lying on that study sofa, I had sensations which you can imagine. And at once I knew that the enemy would take advantage of the vague longings and tendernesses to try and make me believe later on that he had the fulfillment that I really wanted. So I balked him, which means I resisted him, by letting the longings go even deeper and turning my mind to the one, the real object of all desire. Jesus is who we are all really wanting in all our wants. All our sexuality, whether we're single or married, is actually an expression in our body of union with Jesus. And a marriage expresses that as a little prophetic act. The way husband and wife love each other is a little window. It's a prophetic act in this age of the union of the age to come. And if we're single, that longing and that desire is about expressing the ultimate longing and desire for union with Christ. I love this phrase from Thomas Aquinas. And the passion of love is not aroused suddenly, but is born of an earnest consideration of the object loved. So it's not just about what we're not doing. It's about an absolute wholehearted worship and devotion of Jesus, expressed in self-sacrificial agape love for our neighbor. If we don't feel the cost of love, we're moving in self-gratification. But if we feel it, we know what we're doing is costly, then we're moving in agape love. And we will come fully alive and experience that heaven on earth, that mountaintop that we can experience in this age. And we'll have a robust enough sexuality that when the strains and stresses and the intensity of life press on us, we'll stand on the rock and we will thrive as individuals, families and communities. So what's our final takeaway? How do we fulfill the Torah? How do we access the good life? How do we embody the prophetic community anticipating the new creation? We ruthlessly eliminate self-gratification from our lives. So we can all do that in all ways. This is particularly talking about the objectification of women, but it can be in any area. And we replace this with Jesus's way of dealing with the other, self-sacrificial agape love. And I've got a little acronym, because we love an acronym, don't we? It's called WIN. How to win. Firstly, we weed. If you imagine your life or your marriage is a garden or your family, just get the weeds out. The lies, the delusions, the unrealities, the fantasies, just weed them. Confess your sins to one another. Get them in the light just every day. I've talked about this before. There are some things that are very big weeds. I think we have to be careful and appropriate with how we deal with those, and that might be a season of counselling or therapy to deal with specific stuff, but we can always just be weeding the garden, just taking captive every thought that isn't in alignment with Jesus's way and making it obedient to Christ. And then we invest, we sow, for example, in our marriage, Chris and I. We have time together every week. Like, we have a day date, because this is a good season for us. If it was the evenings, it doesn't really matter. It's just time together. We have, every day, we have a prayer walk together. So daily, weekly, and then annually, we go away together. It is never convenient to go away together. It is always costly. It's always time consuming. It's always opposed. But we always do, every year. And we just had our 20th wedding anniversary in Florence. And I can tell you, that mountain is true. There is a way we can live that colludes with the harem and ends up in loneliness, or that lives, whether we're single or married, in alignment with that vision of mutuality, and we experience God's agape love for us. It's true. What he's saying is true. It comes with a ruthless elimination of self-gratification and a contending for replacing that with agape, self-sacrificial love. And then finally, the good news is the word new. We've come today. Some of us, like, it was a fight to even get here because of our life circumstances. Maybe our last night, maybe this morning. Our lives are intense. We've come here. We're hearing this thing. We're like, great. I've got an issue here, or that's complicated because of that. Or we all have our bodies we bring to the table on this issue. I particularly feel for couples, now it's pretty much ubiquitous in every couple, 30-something and below. I mean, it is ubiquitous everywhere, but it's particularly intense for that generation. But today we can draw a line in the sand and say, today, not yesterday, today is the day of salvation. Today is the day of favor. Today is the day of new beginnings. At the burning of by Babylon of the temple, that Jeremiah said to those apostate Judah kings, you are going to be kindled in a fire you sacrifice your children in, which is exactly what's happening to us culturally. We've thrown our children under the bus and we're all suffering the consequences. He then says in his lament, in Lamentations, your mercies are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And I find this incredibly hard to stomach. But at the end of King Manasseh's life, in Chronicles, it says he repented and God forgave him. The parable I probably struggle the most with is the one that's really trendy and everyone loves. It's called the prodigal son. Because we love the idea of this man wasting everything, running away to a far off country and going home and being held. But I know what he was wasting his money on. It was women and children in the sex industry. Where else do you go when you're in a far off country with money? It's really hard. But I know that I have to suck it up and agree with the gospel, which says he can come back and be held. I don't get how that works. I know he holds those other people too. But I have to believe that that is the good news. Because that's the claim that Christians make that no one else is making. There is no bridge too far. We haven't gone away. We haven't done the thing. There is nowhere that we can go that we can't come to our senses and return to the Father's love and his embrace. And I don't want to be the person outside the Father's house, angry at the offense of his grace.
Thank you, Alice. Rich, can you just put the last slide on as well? It's got some references on it. Through my inability to be sexually pure, discovered the power of Jesus' death and resurrection. That was for me the big, most significant area of my life where I discovered, you know, how God does what I cannot do. I love sharing my story. it's a little bit. It's not great to share, but it's. I really relate to this because it's how I met Jesus. If you got the computer's died. Okay, sure, no worries. Okay, well, we've got there are some links that Alice has put on there to three podcasts on divorce and on this porn and AI and so on, and they'll be on the notes that go on our website with the talk. You can access the talk notes, and so if you want to access those, recommend those for some more detail. We've run over, meaty topic. If you've got children over at the school, could you go and collect them all in the crypt? Go and collect them. Do take some space to sit in this at some point, even if it's not immediately now, but later in the day. Great to be with you. Great to follow Jesus with you. Love that we can get into this real stuff. And see you next time.